All right, we're on the line with Kirk Varner, who was a WTMA back in the early 70s. When exactly were you at the Nifty 1250, Mr. V?
I actually came to work at the Mighty TMA, because we were instructed always to put the word Mighty in front of the call letters, in 1973. I was hired while I was still a student at North Charleston High School, the original version, and John Trenton was the station manager at the time, and they were looking for somebody to come in on weekends and play tapes of paid religion half hours, and then on Sunday morning from 9 to noon, we ran Casey Kasem's original American Top 40, which, to show you how old I am, was actually shipped in on big vinyl disc every week. And lo and behold, after a period of time, they would let me play a few records in those half hours on Sunday morning that weren't paid for in time. So instead of religion, they got the Kirk Varner Show for 29 minutes in between various religious messages. And then John Scott, J.J. Scott, who was the program director of the station when I first got there, eventually thought it would be acceptable to let me have my own show. So I started working Saturday and Sunday nights from 6 till midnight. And as you have dubbed me, I truly was a teenage disc jockey sensation.
All right, so you were in high school the entire time.
I was until the first half of it, and then I got out of high school and continued to work at TMA all the way into 75 when I got some real employment and started working in television.
All right, did you have a desire to be in radio, or was it just the equivalent of like a McDonald's job to you?
You know what? I was hooked on radio. I grew up in North Charleston, and at the time, what was then 910 on your radio dial was WNCG, which we were told the call letters were picked for Watch North Charleston Grow. And that radio station was literally located over on O'Hare Avenue, I should say, just a short distance from where my grandparents lived. And I got invited to the radio station by a gentleman whose name I have long since forgotten. And I walked into the place, and I thought I'd walked into Nirvana. From that moment on, I wanted to be on the radio more than just about anything I could think of. And through hook or crook and hanging around enough and making enough of a pest of myself, they taught me sort of the basics at NCG and also WKTM, which was the FM station at the time. And we're going back to when KTM was actually Beautiful Music, when there were three FM Beautiful Music stations in Charleston playing dentist office music. And between that, and I have to give a nod to Junior Achievement of Charleston, who had a company inside their program that was sponsored by WNCG and WKTM Radio. And that was sort of where my radio bug bit me hard, and I wanted to be on the radio from that point forward, and that would have been the ripe old age of 13. So from that point going forward, I wanted to be associated with radio, and then that led me to television.
Were you a big fan of WTMA before you came to work there?
You know, John, I can't tell you this because people probably who weren't around at the time won't believe it, but there wasn't any other radio station that anybody under the age of 40 wanted to listen to. You know, TMA, to say that the Mighty TMA was a dominant radio station is just an understatement of huge proportions. It was the radio station that everybody had on the radio, you know, from transistor radios at the beach to the car radios. Anybody who wanted to listen to the music of the day in the 60s, you know, the Beatles, Tom Jones, even the early Rolling Stones, all of those things were being played on WTMA. And it wasn't just the music, which was, of course, the popular music at the time. It was also the people who were on the radio station. I mean, I grew up, you know, listening to John Trenton and Booby Nash. And then, you know, later on, you know, people like Keith Nichols and Gary London and John Burwell. And those guys, some of whom came while I was there, but most of whom were there before I got there, they were celebrities in their own right. And they were the people who you tuned in to listen to, because not only did they play the records that were hot at the time, they were funny. They told jokes that were sometimes corny, sometimes a little risque. But they were always the people who, you know, you just had sort of as the soundtrack of your life at that point. And as a kid growing up in Charleston, you know, there was no other radio station that even was on the radio dial as far as we were concerned.
Why do you think that was?
You know, I think it was the combination of the fact that it was a really well-done radio station. You know, John Trenton as the program director and then later as a general manager just insisted that WTMA sounded like a big-time radio station. I mean, you know, going into radio as an adult, you know, I found out about the legendary stations like WABC in New York and WCFL and WLS in Chicago and even closer-in stations like WQXI in Atlanta or WAPE in Jacksonville. All of those radio stations just had a big time sound about them. The radio station was fun. It was energetic. You know, it played the hits nonstop. There was always something going on there. And TMA was the same thing. It really had this sense that there was always action going on there. And if you flipped on the radio dial, you knew you were going to hear the records of the day and the hits that people were, you know, listening to as music in that time. But there also were these amazing announcers who made it all happen and put it all together, and you would hear them, you know, talking about doing fun things or making fun of each other or where their next public appearance was going to be. And really from, you know, the mid-60s on, they were the radio station that really just was the young, energetic, hip radio station, and that was the calling of the era. You know, the 60s were about, you know, the young, fun, up-and-coming, energetic, you know, time, and that was the radio station that people identified with.
All right, so you're a teenage disc jockey, or even before you were a disc jockey, you're a tape jockey.
Yep.
What's it like, WTMA being the big radio station that everybody under the age of 14, needless to say, all the kids in high school listen to? You get a chance to work there. What was that like?
People didn't believe it at first. It was really interesting to me because, God bless them, the radio station did have the ability to make even a teenage boy's voice sound good. And God knows I practiced enough that trying to make my voice sound good. But it was interesting. In the beginning, people didn't quite believe it. And it was one of the reasons why I used my own name on the air and didn't have a radio name that was made up for me, because I wanted people to know it was me. And my friends at first didn't quite believe it. I think the only people who really believed it in the beginning were my parents. And even they, I think, were skeptical that I was, you know, going out at the age of 15 or 16 years old on a Sunday morning to the radio station. But it was great. The best benefit of being at the radio station as a senior in high school was that my senior English teacher, to her credit, actually would be nice to me. And if I had filled in on an all-night shift the night before at the radio station, keeping it on the air, she wouldn't give me too hard of a time if I wasn't paying a lot of attention in class, as long as I didn't fall asleep and start snoring in the back of the classroom.
Okay, so you're a teenage disc jockey in high school working at the number one radio station in town. Did that have any impact on your personal life?
Wow. You know, is this the National Enquirer part of the program?
You would think that any red-blooded American boy from North Charleston would use that to his advantage, if you
know
what
I mean.
Yes,
you would think so, wouldn't you? But that would require that you were available to go out on a Saturday night, and of course, I was always working. So it didn't help my love life as much as I would have hoped it would have. And I hate saying this because I probably will live to regret it, but in the early years at TMA, it did not, because I spent pretty much every moment that I wasn't at home or in school at the radio station. So I guess the reality is that probably cut down on my dating life. A little later on, I think it helped introduce me to a few nice girls who I think were a little impressed that I was on the radio station. But, you know, then they found out what a nerd I was and they probably dumped me immediately. So I can say that being at the Mighty TMA made me a minor celebrity of sorts, but I don't think it did as much for my love life as it may have for others, let's say.
Do you recall how much money you made?
I made a whopping $2.35 an hour at the time. It wasn't bad money at the time, but they paid me well, and the checks always cashed. And I think after taxes, I took home 50 cents. I'm not exactly sure. But the other day, proving how old I really am, I got a statement from the Social Security folks. And, you know, they tell you how much you've earned every year of your life. And I went back to the fact that that I think 1975, I did actually break $1,000 for the full year of working. So that was pretty solid where I came from at the time. But it was a great experience. And, you know, I don't think people understand, because radio has sort of taken on a different role in our lives now. But the Mighty TMA was a great experience. I got to work with some amazing people who taught me a lot of things that I, to this day, kind of fall back on, not only about life, but about the business and publicity and how you want to deal with those things. And they were all, to a man, I have to say, really nice about taking this teenage kid under their wings and treating him as if he were an adult and if he were as a big-time radio personality. And I will never, ever forget John Trenton, J.J. Scott, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but Booby Nash and Gary London. And I have to give a special mention here to the person who probably affected my career more in those days than anybody, and that would be Keith Nichols. Keith was a great mentor working at the radio station, and was the guy I wanted to be because he was a little older, had come from Columbia, had gone to the University of South Carolina, but was great. And actually, it was Keith that sort of pointed me towards television, which he eventually went to work in. And I sort of followed in those footsteps, but I decided to stay behind the camera and end up in a managerial role than be in front of the camera. But a great guy, and really I owe a lot to.
All right, let's talk about some of those people that you work with at WTMA, the folks you mentioned. John Trenton, he was the program director, later became the general manager. What was he like?
John was an impressive, and I have to say it for a 15-year-old kid, an intimidating guy. He had that amazing voice of his, and he had that ability to kind of look you in the eye, and just, at least for me, was a little scary sometimes. John hired me at the radio station. I got word that they were looking for somebody to work part-time, and through a friend, got John's name and called him up, and I think sent him a letter, actually, and he was nice enough to take my call and said, okay, come on in, let's talk to you, and did, I guess, what would be the first really serious interview I'd ever had for a job. And he asked me a couple of questions and let me fidget and be nervous the whole time, and when it came down to a crucial moment in the interview where he asked me if I had my FCC license, and I said honestly that I did, but unfortunately at the time you had to have an FCC third-class radio telephone license with broadcast endorsement, and I had not passed my broadcast endorsement test, and I figured he was just going to flow me out of the building, and he didn't. And to his credit, he said, no, you know what, we can get you a waiver, but you got to go back and take the test again, and this time you better pass it. And I think when he said you better pass it, I hitched up inside a little bit, and I think that was the motivation to study hard and go pass the test. But John was a great guy. You know, by the time I got to TMA, he had actually taken himself off the air and was just running the station full-time at that point, and had put Boob on as the morning man. And he was a great guy to work for, but a little scary sometimes because he was very fixed on the fact that he knew what he wanted WTMA to be, and he wasn't going to let anybody, least of all a 15-year-old kid, not deliver on that.
All right, what about Booby Nash?
Booby Nash, what can you say about Uncle Boob other than the fact that what you heard on the radio was an amazing ability of this man to open a microphone and to entertain like entertainers used to do, basically. But off the air, you know, Boob was sometimes a quiet guy and mostly a person who was so focused on its performance, you know, he would get mad if you would come into the studio when you weren't supposed to or interrupt him in some fashion. But having said that, he was always great to me and treated me, you know, like a guy who had been doing it for a while, and every now and then would call me kid, but would treat me in a great way. And, you know, the thing about Boob was that when he would open the microphone, you just never knew where he was going to go. And if anybody ever taught me the definition of how to be outrageous but yet still be kept on the air long before, you know, the people like Don Imus and Howard Stern ever did this on the radio, it would be Uncle Boob.
All right, J.J. Scott. I don't know too much about him. I know he was the program director, probably did an air shift.
Yeah, he did. You know, J.J. was a tall guy and was sort of a rock and roll guy. And he and Bill Dudley, who was the chief engineer when I first got to TMA, were roommates. And J.J. had an amazing set of pipes. I mean, maybe one of the best voices ever on the radio station, and was a great production man. Did all of the promo work and actually the little short, what we called shotgun jingle of the call letters didn't really exist until J.J. went into an audio booth one day and spent, I think, about 12 hours editing down a longer piece of music to get that exact little second and a half shotgun jingle that ran on the air for years after that. And he was just an amazing guy in the booth. He eventually went to Chicago and the radio station there, WFYR, as a air personality and as a production manager, but was the guy who I think probably taught me the beginnings of what it was like and what it meant to be on the air and how it was important to keep the sound tight and only open the microphone when you had something to say and you kept it, you know, upbeat and to the point. And he was good about listening to my work and occasionally giving me a little criticism when it deserved it, which was most of the time. And then the rest of the time being encouraging and a very nice guy.
The program director after him was a guy by the name of Lee Richards. He also did the morning show.
Well, and I should be clear, JJ actually was a midday guy because Boob was on in the mornings and then JJ was in the middle of the day. Lee came in and was hired to be the program director after JJ left. And Lee really was the guy who I think brought the radio station into sort of the 70s and focused it on the researching of the records. You know, that science of which records to play and how often to play them was really coming of age in the late 60s and early 70s and what was known as Top 40 radio. And it wasn't just playing the same 40 records over and over again. It was figuring out which records that were off the charts were ones people still wanted to hear and which new songs we would play. And Lee really was a great mentor to me because he began to let me work in that end of the business and understand why the music was important and which songs people wanted to hear and how they would get played on the radio. And Lee was very much more of sort of what was, you know, sometimes negatively called, but I think really positive, a time and temp kind of radio guy. He was focused on you got in, you said what you had to say, and you got out, basically. And it was not as loose a format for the radio station for anybody, frankly, when Lee was the program director. But he tightened up the air sound and made what was a good station, I would say, even better at that point.
What about Gary London?
Gary London, big Gary London. Gary, another guy with an amazing set of pipes. When I first was at the radio station, I want to say Gary came in as the 7 to midnight guy and was, you know, a local boy from the low country, but really just had this amazing sound about him. And Gary taught me some things that I'll never forget in terms of what it was like to handle the off-air part of the job, if you will, and the people who would call in and how to do that in a presence where you made those people feel like they were part of the show, even if they never got the song they requested on the radio. And you know, TMA didn't at the time do a lot of phone work in the sense that people who called into the radio station didn't end up on the air a lot. But Gary did that from time to time and did it really well. And he was a great guy. And I think maybe the tallest guy who ever worked at TMA because when he would sit in the chair in that air studio, he'd have to take the microphone up about as high as he could get it on the stand there so it would reach him. And he had a following and then eventually moved to afternoons. And I think at one point ended up with maybe the highest ratings a radio station had ever had in afternoon drive time with people listening when they were on their way home from work.
All right, Steve Russell.
Steve Russell, the guy who became the production wizard after JJ left. Steve was an amazing guy in terms of doing the air shift, but also in terms of producing the commercials. And I have to remind people that in that day, you know, most of the commercials we did, we all produced locally. There were very few national commercials on the radio station. Most of them were, you know, the local spots for car dealers and restaurants and a few institutions that were places that hopefully we won't talk too much about in great detail now. The Joker Lounge, of course, would be the legendary spots that Steve worked on and Boob would voice or Steve would voice. But Steve, you know, I want to say I believe from Bamberg, South Carolina, if memory serves correctly, and came to the radio station and just lived there. I mean, he really was a guy who I think put in more hours than anybody at the time, at least as I recall from those years later on. But I think at one point, his voice appeared probably on almost every radio station in the market along the way because he launched a pretty successful business where he was selling his voiceover talents. But when he was at TMA, he was a smooth guy and one of the good guys. You know, that was what TMA called all of us in the beginning in terms of the on-air personality. We were known as the TMA good guys. And I'm not sure we were always good, at least off the air, but on the air we were always told to be that.
All right, John Burwell.
John Burwell came and I think started on the overnight shift, if memory serves correctly, and then moved to 7 to midnights. And John was maybe the best guy I have ever witnessed in a radio station in terms of talking up the post. Now, I should explain that talking up the post is a radio term, which means talking over the beginning of the record, but not actually speaking over the actual singing part of the record. The instrumental portion of the song would play. And it was a skill that all disc jockeys aspired to do really well, is to, you know, say something very quickly over the first few seconds of the song and deliver something that would often be a joke that the song would reinforce. And John did that with a skill that I've seen very few, or heard, I should say, very few people do, and was just an impressive guy. And I have to say, was always exceptionally nice to me and treated me as if I was as equal a professional, which of course I wasn't, but at least he was nice enough to make me think I was.
All right, Keith Nichols.
Keith Nichols is, in my mind, the quintessential TMA guy. Keith came to the radio station, I think, about a year before I got there, and was working middays at the time. And Keith was the guy who first kind of introduced me to what radio stations in other parts of the country sounded like, and pointed out what were the things to try to emulate and to be like. And was a solid guy and a good friend. And as I said, was the guy who kind of said to me, you know, the radio thing is fun, but you're going to want to have a career. And really, the future of the business is more in TV than radio. And I think that was Keith's nice way of saying that I probably didn't have the voice to end up in a major market working in radio, so I might want to consider some other career options in the communications industry.
Who am I leaving out?
Wow, who are we leaving out? Billy Smith. Billy was on the air when I first got to TMA, and Billy was another just amazing talent. I think is working up in Myrtle Beach now and has been there for a number of years. Ted Bell, who's also with Billy up there. Ted was interesting in that Ted had been on the radio at WTMA and then moved over as the first full-time employee of what became WPXI. You know, we used to have to play at the top of each hour at TMA where it said WTMA AM and WTMA FM. But the FM side was eventually turned off of the simulcast and moved over to first a beautiful music format, which Ted ran and did all the voicers for. And he had a voice that was just amazing. And Ted later hired me in Orangeburg, South Carolina, when I was trying to go to school. And I worked for Ted at what was then the mighty 1580 WORG radio in Orangeburg, South Carolina, a radio station that was so powerful that it went off the air when the sun went down. But that was built as sort of a faithful imitation of WTMA up in Orangeburg. And Ted was a great guy and still is a wonderful person. And he and his family took me in and helped me get my first full-time employment kind of going after high school and trying to move on to higher education. So he was there. There were a few others, I'm sure, along the way who came and went. But those were sort of the core of the radio station. You know, Uncle Boob and Lee Richards held down the morning shift, and then J.J. Scott, and then later on Keith Nichols. Afternoons were first Booby, but then Gary London and John Burwell doing 7 to midnight, and then yours truly carried up the weekends. I was a very impressionable young guy of 15, 16, 17 years old, and I looked up to these guys like they were nobody's business, and you know, they really were heroes to me. And like I said, it was nice because, you know, a lot of times in life, you meet your heroes, and they turn out to be something other than what you've made them to be. And I'm not saying that these guys couldn't occasionally treat me, you know, like I was a kid. They did, but they were also really decent to me, and they lived up to the billing, if you will, in the sense that just to watch them work sometimes was an amazing education. You know, I mentioned Keith Nichols, and Keith had work habits that you would watch him do and how he did what he did off the air, not just how he opened the microphone and was a personality on the air, but how he conducted himself and how he was as a professional. You know, those kind of things are lessons that can stay with somebody when they're at a young, impressionable age, and I was, and they were great.
All right, what about the news people? Did you have much interaction with them?
I did. You know, we had, and it's almost cliche to say, but we had a great news department at the time. There were three people working in the news department, which is just unheard of for a radio station these days, but they were the guys who really, really drove drove the news business and delivered this just amazing sound. Al Cammie was the news director, did the morning drive news shift, and taught me a lot about what made up news. And because I work in news now, I have to thank Al because he kind of pointed me in that direction. Steve Bell was the afternoon guy and did also just an amazing job on news. And then Arthur Kornicki was the guy who did the late nights and weekend fill-in work. In fact, I think on the air check that you've so graciously posted on WTMAMemories.com, you'll actually hear part of an Arthur Kornicki newscast that was in the middle of one of my air shifts.
All right, what about promotions? Any good radio station does a lot of giveaways and things to try to increase listenership. I'm sure WTMA was no exception. Do you remember anything noteworthy that TMA did that kind of stood out from the usual caller five, name it and claim it type stuff?
You know, there was a lot of the name it and claim it kind of thing. We were constantly giving away records and major cash prizes, which I think ranged from $5 to $50. TMA didn't give away a lot of money per se, but they gave away everything else, it felt like. We did give away a car. And I think there was some concern that the car might have been given away without an engine, but as it turned out, it did actually have an engine. The contest that probably sticks out in my mind the most from when I was there was something that they had worked with some out-of-town folks on, something called the Fame Game. And the Fame Game was interesting because you send in a postcard with your name and address, and then we would pick a number of them each week, and they would be shipped off, I think, to someplace in California, and singers would sing your name. And if you heard your name sung on the radio, you had a certain amount of time to call in and claim your prize. But that was interesting because a number of people who I knew would call me up and say, can't you get my name on the Fame Game? And of course, the answer was no. It had to be done, you know, very fair for everyone. But the problem was is that the folks in California would occasionally sing names that looked like on paper what they should sound like. But of course, in the low country, there are some names that don't quite sound the way they look. And that led to some hilarious moments where we would have names sung on the air that people would call up and go, well, that's just not my name, but I think it might be my name. And we'd have to deal with some of those things. But there were a few of those things. I want to say that I believe at one point they locked Uncle Boob up in a travel trailer and put him up on top of a billboard. And he lasted up there for maybe a couple of weeks. I think the first thing that they had to do when they got him down was de-louse him, because it was a little tough being in a trailer in the Carolina humidity for 2 weeks' time. But there was always a contest going on where we're about giving away something, and most of the time it was giving away the music or the big money jackpot, which the biggest one I can remember ever giving away on the air was, I think, for $72.46.
Boy, that's some serious money there.
Well, we were concerned because giving away $72.46 in many cases would have exceeded my weekly check. So I was concerned that there might not be enough money in the bank left over, but there fortunately always was. And the checks did never bounce, at least while I was working there.
All right. Were you there when Ted Turner actually owned the radio station?
I was, as a matter of fact. In fact, for a while, my checks were actually signed by R.E. Turner III, and I didn't quite know who that was. And years later, in my adulthood, I actually met Ted Turner in Atlanta on a business meeting and introduced myself to him. And I told him that it was great because at the time I was working for Time Warner, which had merged with Ted Turner's company, Turner Broadcasting. And I told Mr. Turner that I had actually worked for him twice, once back in the 70s at WTMA Radio. And he was thrilled by that. And he said, oh, that's right. Yeah, we own those radio stations. A gentleman by the name of Charles Smith actually was the local manager in Charleston and a part owner of the radio stations. But yep, Ted Turner owned WTMA and actually owned at that point all of the outdoor billboards around Charleston, all had Turner written on the bottom of them, because that was what the start of the business was. His empire began because his father had been in the the billboard business in a number of southeastern markets, including Charleston. And yep, that's true. Ted Turner was the owner of the mighty TMA and a couple of other radio stations in Chattanooga, and he sold those eventually to have enough money to buy his first TV station in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then that led him to Atlanta and what we now know as TBS and CNN, and the empire grew on from there.
All right, why did you leave WTMA?
I left actually to get a full-time job in television. A company had started in North Charleston, which was the predecessor of Comcast now, and they began building the cable TV system, and they were looking for full-time people to work behind the scenes producing and programming the local TV channels there. And I stayed with TMA for a while doing both jobs, but it was sort of not to be for a long-term proposition, and I had to make a decision, and probably it's the one decision of my professional career that if I had to go back and do all over again, I might not do, because I think working at WTMA, at least in the early 70s, when it was still such a flame-throwing powerhouse of a radio station, was just more fun than I can possibly describe to you. It was a job, and it was work, and you had to be serious about that, but it was also a lot of fun, and everybody who worked there, at least in my viewpoint, made the experience just one of the best of my life. And you know, TMA really is a treasure, and in that era from the 60s until, you know, the late 70s, when it sort of began its decline and the onset of FM radio, and TMA fought them all off. TMA fought off a charge from WCSC, which tried to take it on at one point, fought off a charge from WKTM, which was really the first station to play, you know, contemporary music on the FM dial at that point, and even a late charge at one point from WQSN, which called itself 15Q. You know, they all kind of came and they all put up their best efforts, but TMA was just too strong for too long in that period of time, and it was the place in terms of being on the radio dial. You know, when you talk about the history of WTMA, you have to talk about the fact that it was this good, solid, professional organization. It was never anything other than a radio station that people outside of Charleston talked about as if it were, because it really was, one of the best radio stations in the Southeast. It didn't really dawn on me until after I'd moved away how WTMA was talked about in the ranks of being, you know, one of the radio stations in the late 60s and early 70s that ranked among the best of the best. And it was that way because the people who worked there were really dedicated to the craft. They were really into radio. They really loved it. It was a job and it was work, and I don't want to romanticize it too much, but all of the people who you heard on the air at the radio station, these were all professionals who just came in and did the very best work. And it was work that people loved to listen to. And WTMA was number one for so long because the people who made it sound that way were great people, and the people in Charleston recognized that, and they knew this was their radio station, and if there was something happening in Charleston, be it a serious thing that was on the news or a fun thing that was on the radio, the first place you were going to hear about it. The internet wasn't around, iPods weren't around, TV wasn't even quite what it is today, but the radio still drove people's lives, and the number one radio station in Charleston for pretty much everybody was the mighty TMA, and it was called that because it was a pretty mighty influence there at the time, and it was just an amazing thing to be part of. I don't know that anybody could do it, but if there was ever a radio station that, boy, needed to be reconstituted and brought back to life, you know, on the FM dial where the quality would be great and you could hear that kind of radio again, boy, WTMA was that kind of radio station. And you know, it's funny because I was thinking about this. There really isn't an oral history of the radio business, you know, and we're starting to lose some of those people now who were the legends of radio as it moved from the 50s into the 60s and then into the 70s. And that time radio was just such a dynamic medium that so powered the lives of younger people in particular, that you got up and the first thing you did was flip the radio on. And when you got your driver's license, really the thing it meant is that you were able to drive around town, you know, with the radio on, you know, and listen to the radio or go to the beach with the radio. And it was just such an important part of everybody's life at the time that it's hard to understand now because we have so many different options, you know, on how to get our music and entertainment. But at the time, it was the thing, and it was fun to be a part of, no doubt.